Hi folks, welcome to this episode of the Newsprint Commando. This is a Pacific Tuesday episode. I'm your host, Ed Moore. But for those of you that may be new to both the show and this particular episode type of the show, every Tuesday I've been looking at the books published by Pacific Comics. About 3 years worth of production. So we're, about halfway through, I guess. We're looking at the books that came out in July of 1983 from Pacific Comics. The first book that I'll be looking at is Alien Worlds, issue number 3. But before I dive into that, you guys take some notes here if you want to get in touch. Teal Productions is on Blue Sky and Twitter. News P Commando is on Twitter. The show is Newsprint Commando. The overall, what my wife and I call all the shows that we put out, is Teal Productions. So you can get me either place. Usually Teal Productions on Twitter is the quickest. Teal Productions also has a Facebook page if you like to keep up there. I post the episodes when they go live on Facebook. IamIndieMan@gmail.com is the email address. Indie is INDIE. And comicbooknoise.com/TNC, that's letters phonetic Tango November Charlie, in case I'm not enunciating well. Now this book, as I said, Alien Worlds, number 3, I can't find any American reprints for it. So the only way that I know of that you can read it is to get an actual copy of the book, which I have right here in my hand. The covers and pencils are by Mr. William Stout. The cover shows what I would call an astronaut buried up to about his chest in the ground with his partially buried helmet over here to the left of him. He is completely surrounded by these little creatures that look like some sort of prehistoric, lizard-hippo combination kind of thing, and they're closing in on him, presumably to eat him. He certainly is not enjoying the situation that he's at right now. You can tell that by the look on his face. All right, inside, this is a full-color cover here for us. Inside, sorry about that phone, if you heard it. Inside front cover is the letters page, the stratospheric scribblings, all addressed to 8423 Production Avenue in San Diego, California, 1983. Jerry Kuttner, Stephen Thomas, Aldous Rapsis, Carlton Lee, and Gary Woodling all have letters printed here. Moving on to the first story, and those names don't really stand out to me. Nothing really dropped as far as the letters page. I can't even tell really that they answered any of the letters. Doesn't look like they did, so. First story, The Inheritors. This is brought to us by Bruce Jones. Penciled, inked, and colored by Scott Hampton, lettered by Perry McCarthy. We start off following Beth and Ard, A-R-D. Ard is our narrator. He's our POV character for this story. Now, these creatures that we see, starting off with Beth and Ard, that's who we're following around, they are very curious-looking creatures. They're humanoid, but they look more like... if you remember that X-Files episode that had the human leech combination kind of dude, or the tapeworm dude that swam around in the sewage plant there that Mulder and Scully found, I believe it was tapeworm. They kind of look like that. They're very pale white, no hair. They've got very large, almost bulbous eyes, kind of like a gray, like the alien gray is often drawn. And the mouth is this, it looks almost like a remora mouth, like some sort of sucker mouth on there. And they're walking around, two arms, two legs, long, flowing, billowing, bluish coats and cloaks and what have you. So that's the, according to them, dominant species of the planet. Turns out that what has happened is mankind has led themselves to some sort of nuclear destructive, killing most of the human beings, most of the life on the planet itself. These creatures come from somewhere else, and I believe we get some pretty strong clues at the end of the story. But they are not humanoid, but over time they have been making themselves humanoid through medical surgical application. So they are constructing people that are more humanoid than previous, with the idea that ultimately they will take the place of the humans that have essentially disappeared from the surface of the planet. So that is also one of the things that leads me to believe they are from somewhere, if not another planet, then they're an oceanic species. And like I said, I think you get some definite clues by the end of the story. In the midst of being caught up on things here, as the narrator, Ard, is telling us, and that's A-R-D, Ard. Again, I apologize if I'm not enunciating well. But Ard and Beth and several others are walking around, and they are attacked by a human being, a man. And we're told usually once the wretched creature's wrath is spent, it either shambled off again or died quietly, its system succumbing at last to the nuclear poisons swimming within it. And they just let the human creature attack and kill and dispatch whomever it wants to, because it typically doesn't last very long, but also because these creatures are supreme pacifists. They are not physically engaging the humans. They're not protecting themselves. They're not doing anything like that. Here, their teacher, one night over a campfire, one of the girls, Beth, actually asks, why can we not sing the soul song, O teacher? And the teacher says, it's no longer permitted, Beth. It's a reminder of what we were. We are the dominant species of the planet Earth now. We must learn to walk on man's land, breathe his way, sing his songs. We cannot go back ever. So I'm not sure why the press to become like man. I mean, you would think if they are intelligent enough to see that man failed via this whatever nuclear bad thing that they brought about, why then would you want to be just like man when man has failed? But there we go. So now we're talking about they're getting to the point where physically and I guess psychologically they're close to human. Now they're having to go through genital reconstruction so that they can reproduce like human beings do. And Beth is upset about the reconstruction because she has heard that it's very painful, perhaps the most painful of the surgical procedures that they will undergo in transitioning from whatever they were to human. Ard is trying to assuage her fear. Doesn't really work out well. At some point in the future, Ard is walking around again with a group of these individuals, and they're attacked by another human being. And this human being jumps out and grabs him. I guess the point of this is just to once again show that these new creatures are supremely pacifistic and that human beings have become the brutal animals that we know ourselves to be. And after this attack, another one of these creatures comes out yelling for Ard, telling him that Beth, her operation didn't go well, and she stumbled away bleeding profusely and not in her right mind because of the amount of pain. I don't know. I guess they don't put them under to do that. I don't know. Maybe I'm digging in too far. This is a very, not esoteric, but it definitely has a higher level meaning, and I may or may not have gotten it reading it, to be perfectly honest with you. So Ard goes running out and he finds Beth. She has torn her clothes off trying to get to her original state, her natural state, but she was not able to accomplish it because she bled out. She died. And Ard asked if she could be buried at sea because it's closer to her home, but the people in charge refused because now they are land-dwelling creatures like humans, and so everything that they do must be land-dwelling. So we are then introduced to Kath, who has been chosen to be the paramour. She is being bonded to Ard. Kath has already undergone the genital reconstruction. Apparently Ard has as well. We see another scene where another human runs out and he jumps on the newly introduced Kath. But Ard, being sick and tired of this, picks up a rock and clocks him in the back of the head, killing him. And Ard is very distraught. I have done a terrible thing. I had gone against all my teachings at the bubble. Perhaps we're becoming more human than we know, Kath, he says as he is standing there holding his killing rock, looking down at the dead human, as is Kath. Now they start running. He is very distraught, and they run to a cliff overlooking the ocean. And as they're talking, we see a couple dolphins, perhaps hint, breaching through the water and diving back down into the water as our two survivors from another environment are talking and consoling each other, and finally having clumsy, unsure sex with their newly reconstructed genitals here, Ard and Kath. So after that, all of these creatures meet at one time of day here down at the beach, and the teacher tells them, "Tomorrow you will undergo the final operation linking you forever with the human race. Your operation to seal your breathing hole." So that tells me they must be aquatic. In the previous page, we saw a couple dolphins swimming around. So perhaps these are dolphins, which arguably are the dominant species on Earth as far as numbers anyways. Maybe. So, "I know how much you miss your home." This is their teacher. "Your friends, how much you'd like to be among them again. I have therefore decided to remove your collars one day early," because the collar covered the blowhole and forced them to breathe through the reconstructed mouth esophagus structures that they had. A gasp of elation went up from the group as the key was passed around. "A great rush of air entered my lungs as the collar was pulled free." Again, this is Ard. The teacher, "Run, my children, run and be free one last time." And we see Ard and Kath diving among the oceans, playing with the dolphins, again, to, I guess, symbolize that perhaps that's who these were, is advanced dolphins who have force-advanced huge numbers of their people. "Oh, let us stay close in this world of our birth. Oh, let our 6 billion be one. Though this song that we sing in the clear ocean air over endless green waves that we love." And that's the final panel there. So I guess what has happened is man killed themselves off, and for whatever reason, the dolphins felt that they had to replace man on land and managed somehow to advance themselves to where they were able to then continuing advancing other members of their species to this bipedal mouth-breathing external genital having like humans. Every time they would also, the humans would die after attacking them. They would take the creature and they would dissect it and investigate its structure. So they knew what humans were built like, and they were trying to build themselves in the same manner. It's an interesting thought. I fail to see why the dolphins would choose to do that. I mean, like I say, arguably, as far as the ocean, dolphins are thought to be very intelligent. And so that probably makes them the pinnacle species in the ocean. Why come to land again to be like human beings that have shown nothing but destruction? Yeah, I'm not sure I understand that. So, all right. Second story. We have three in this issue. Second story is Pi in the Sky. This is scripted for us by Bruce Jones, penciled, inked, and colored by Ken Stacey, and lettered by Kerry McCarthy. Now, this is a jet aeroplane flying machine story. We have the Green Dragon and the Red Bear as our two protagonists. And this starts with the Green Dragon, and he's flying around, and there are the panel process in the book is very interesting. It's a multi-panel, two-page spread every 2 pages. But the panels are not geometrically shaped, and they're not geometrically placed. Geometrically, is that? Yeah, I'm not sure. Maybe that's not the right word. But it's not the typical square, rectangular panel structure that we see. And it's not a 9-panel grid that we see or anything like that. The panels are varying size. Like this first 2-page spread has 2, 4, 6, 8 panels. A third of the page is one panel across the 2 pages. But the rest are, there are some irregularly shaped. There's a circular one, there's a triangular one, hard edges. Negative space is used to divide the panels into separate them across the page and up and down. So we have text blocks that also take up very large portions of the artwork. So Bruce here is in the process of writing the great American novel and not really leaving his man much time to illustrate, because there is much text space here to get the story across to us, which I don't think is necessary, because the majority of the text is used to cue us in on the fact that these planes are rapidly, at the press of a button, changing structure. Case in point, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, let's see if that's it. Yeah, 4 2-page spreads, so that's 8 pages. The Green Dragon goes from being a Phantom 7 X-94 Saber Shark to a Sky Rider. That's what he uses to try to antagonize and call in the Red Bear. He starts out flying by himself. And then after the Sky Rider, he becomes a Mark 9 Cloud Whomper, and then a Silas 7 River Raker, and then a NASA Needle Nudger. Okay, and all of these planes, as you see them, look some different, but not profoundly different. A Red Bear shows up as a Sand Shark 580, and then becomes a Coral Cracker 1040, and finally a Bulldog Basher. And a lot of the text is telling us these changes, and then what armaments or what capabilities, to some extent, these individual planes have. And that's why Red Dragon and then Red Bear change from one to the other, as the situation and environment over which they're flying change. These are machines are changing to try to get the advantage over the other. There's just the two, Green Dragon and Red Bear. So finally, in the midst of this dogfight, Red Bear exclaims, "Dragon, can't hold her, blacking out." And Red Dragon says, "Huh? What's the matter? Is this a ruse, Red Bear?" And Red Bear continues, "Can't see Bobby, help." So the Green Dragon's real name is Bobby. And actually, we find out that Red Bear's real name is Dan, because Bobby hops up out of his console that is in the center of his bedroom and runs out the door, down a hall, and across the street to where Dan lives. Dan is likewise in a similar contraption. Well, Dan dies of a presumed heart attack, I guess. But before he dies, he tells Green Dragon, Bobby, about the purple button. Purple button is the key. So Bobby takes Dan out and buries him. He assumes responsibility for Dan's princess, who is an Irish setter, brown, sad brown eyes, Irish setter. And then Bobby goes to looking for this purple button. He looks all around. He's like, "I know this rig that Red Bear was playing in. It doesn't have a purple button anywhere. So he must have installed it somewhere." So he goes checking everything and finds the purple button, hits it, and finds out that all of the dogfights between Green Dragon and Red Bear over the years, however long it's been, were all recorded by Dan. So now Bobby doesn't have to worry about never seeing Dan again, his friend, his best friend, his only friend, perhaps the only two human beings left on the planet, we don't know, because all of their interactions online or in this computer game have been recorded. Now, before he darted back inside Red Dragon after burying Dan, Green Dragon after burying Dan, Red Bear, he glanced up at the ugly, boiling, blood-colored, radioactive sky. The clouds were thick and green and pregnant with poison. So apparently, human beings yet again scorched the sky, much like they did in the first Matrix movie, we're told. Only this is a little bit different. Green Dragon chuckled to the princess, "A good morning, a good day for a hunt." And so I don't know, maybe he gets back in his rig and plays solo, I don't know, but his interactions with Dan the Red Bear are forever memorialized in the videotaping that Red Dragon did. Excuse me, that Red Bear did. I don't know why I have such a problem separating. Sorry. All right, next page is a mock-up black and white image of the Bernie Wrightson Master of the Macabre issue number 2, which is the next book we'll be talking about after this. Another 3 stories. They are 3 horror stories, as this is 3 science fiction stories. All right, the third story here in this issue is entitled Dark Passage. It is scripted by Bruce Jones, penciled and inked by Tom Yates, colored by Steve Olaf, with letters by Kerry McCarthy. This is the story of Rob and Tazy, and by extension, Mr. Ukeli, something like that. Now, Rob is a young man who is Caucasian. Tazy is a young female who is black. We see them running around here in a field, and they run up to a what's supposed to be a chain link fence. It's a little fancier than that, but essentially a chain link fence. Looking over at a launch pad on which is the silver rocket. Wait, let me see. That's not, I don't think that is what they called it. What do they call it here? Silver needle. I'm sorry, there it is. The silver needle, which is just a large spaceship sitting on a launch pad waiting for launch. But it's something that Rob and Tazy have grown up with, and they have had fantastic stories, made-up stories, dreams, pretended things, and everything around this big rocket. So they run up to the fence here, and they're looking through it, and Rob has these grandiose dreams of going places and doing things with Tazy as his companion. Them always together as they jet around and rocket around and go to places and have adventures and ultimately settle down as man and wife and have kids and family and, you know, the little house with the picket fence and the gate and the mailbox and all that. That's what Rob dreams, and Tazy kind of goes along with it. Someday you'll grow up, Rob. Someday you'll want a wife, a girl of your own kind. And Rob says, don't ever say that. You're my kind. You're going to be my wife. It's you I want, nobody else. And of course, you know, Rob being the Caucasian male and Tazy being a black female, race is the assumed message here that Mr. Jones is trying to get across to us. We have several images now moving on of them growing up. They're playing in town here. Some of the townspeople kind of look at Rob with kind of a look, but he ignores them. They're playing in the woods here one day, and Tazy's attacked by a very, very large snake. And Rob blisters it, zaps it with a ray gun that he's carrying around with him. That night, they go back home to Tazy's home, and that's where we see Mr. Ukeli. Ukeli? Yeah. Who is positioned to be Tazy's dad. The older black man telling them stories, the kids' stories, and just giving their creative juices more power to run on. We have an image of school where Rob is taking up for Tazy as the other, oddly enough, the other white boys in school are talking trash about her, and he gets in a fist fight and gets in trouble, but to no avail. His days off when he gets in trouble, he and Tazy are running around and playing in the fields and looking at the silver needle all over again. At home, though, Rob's mom and dad are starting to fuss at him a little bit about getting older. And here before too long, it'll be time for him to go to college and start thinking of things like that, you know, like girls of your own kind. And Rob's having none of that. He's like, Tazy is who I want to be with. I want to be with Tazy. Tazy is it. It is Tazy. And, you know, just on and on and on. Again, alluding, one would believe, to the racial difference between the two of them. You know, she's not our kind. And so at some point in the future, the barn that is outside Tazy and her dad's place is torched by some other white boys that jumped off the train and came running over and trashed the barn. Well, inside they find Tazy disassembled. So we finally find out the us and them concept. It's not necessarily racial, although there is a racial difference, but it's a human and mechanical difference. So Rob puts Tazy back together. And after this incident, Tazy finally brushes him off and says, you've got to go. This is going to keep happening until something happens to you. And you can't just be put back together. You know, you are flesh and blood, and you will get hurt and die, and not on my watch, not because of me. So just go away. Leave me alone. Grow up. Live your life. So Rob is hurt. He runs off. He's going to go to the silver needle and fly away to one of his dreamlands, you know, that he's always thinking about. But it turns out that At this point, the whole little community there of rockets sitting on launch pads has been changed, and all of those older style rockets have been put up. They've been retired for the new Econo line rockets. And so that part of his dream is gone. So now Tasey has thrown him off. His dream of flying in the Silver Needle is gone. And so he just wanders on down the road, ultimately continuing to live his life. His parents and he eventually move to Venus. He starts a new school there, makes new friends, new girlfriends. He starts college, becomes a doctor, marries, has kids, and then one day has to travel back to Earth to go to a medical convention in the state of Mississippi. So apparently, this is where he's originally, or not maybe not originally, but when the story started, that's where he was living and met Tasey in Mississippi. So taking an opportunity, he takes a cab and goes to visit Mr. Ukeli. And sure enough, he's still there. The house is still there. Mr. Ukeli takes Rob out to a barn, a shed, something, you know, that's taken the place of the barn that burnt down. And there is Tasey sitting there unused for who knows how long. So Rob works on her and works on her and works on her and just can't get her to come to life like she used to be. So Tasey is now forever gone. As he and Mr. Ukeli have some words here about moving on and how she always loved him and she missed him and she's glad he's living a good life and all these things, all the normal mushy-mushy stuff that you would see in a story that's going to have a happy ending of this sort. Rob takes the taxi back, and on the way back, he passes the old launch pads and sees that the Silver Needle is back. And the cabbie tells him, yeah, the old timers wanted it, so they dug it out and put it back in place. So Rob takes off running across the fields, remembering like he used to, he and Tasey running and laughing and dreaming about the Silver Needle and going off and living their happy life together and everything like that. So essentially, the story ends where it started. Next page is a black and white mock-up of several current and upcoming issues of books. We have Michael Moorcock's Elric of Monibane, Alien Worlds, Vanguard Illustrated, Bernie Wrightson, which Vanguard Illustrated is several months away still, Captain Victory and Somerset Holmes. I believe Somerset Holmes is, I think next episode I'll talk about the first issue. Next is a color mock-up of the cover of Michael Moorcock's Elric of Melnibone, issue number 2, by Thomas Russell Gilbert. Inside back cover is a portfolio entitled Midnight Gods, produced by John Pound. And it is 6 interior panes, limited to a total of 1,200 sets for $35 a set and $1.75 postage. So that's $6 a panel. That's quite a lot here. And you have a couple of them here, and they just look like typical fantasy art painted stuff like you would see on the covers of novels for this time period, something like that. And then the outside back cover is a full-color mock-up of Twisted Tales, issue number 4, which, I don't know, that'll be in the next... That might be next month or the month after. I'll be looking at that. Horror Stories to Chill Your Spine, written and edited by Bruce Jones. So that's another horror anthology book, similar to Bernie Wrightson's Master of the Macabre, just not involving Bernie Wrightson. So that's like 3 or 4 anthology books that Pacific is currently coming out with. All right, so that's it for Alien Worlds. Next up, I will be looking at Bernie Wrightson, Master of the Macabre. All right, the cover comes to us penciled and inked by Bernie Wrightson, colored by Steve Olaf, and it is a 60% page, maybe 3/4 of a page, full color on the cover, of a gentleman standing against maybe a door or a tree, with one fist raised up in front of his face, and he is screaming. No text, no narration, nothing like that. Inside front cover, letters page, this is an editorial from Bruce Jones telling us about how and why these stories were chosen, how they came together, which This is a little bit different than what most books have been. I have tried to tell about reprints where you can find these stories elsewhere. The book that I hold in my hand, Bernie Wrights and Master of the Macabre, from Pacific Comics, number 2, July 1983. This is the reprint. Turns out that all of these stories, well, no, they come from different books, but they come either from, well, three of them come from Creepy and one from Eerie, which is from Warren Publishing. Creepy was a horror book, started about 2 years, I think, 2-3 years before Eerie. Black and white anthology books. Warren probably, other than these horror books, is best known for the origin of Vampirella. That's where Vampirella started. I think she started in one of these, Creepier Warren. Warren's the publisher. Creepier Eerie. And eventually got her own book. Very, very quickly, actually, got her own black and white anthology book in which one of the stories would be about her on, you know, 50, 60 issues later. Maybe another story would be about someone else in her retinue, Panthra, or some of the other female vampirises that she met. And the other stories in the anthology were other horror stories. I think they were almost always horror stories. They weren't sci-fi. So, but this book that I hold is the reprint. So starting off, our first story is Jennifer. It first appeared in Creepy issue number 63 from July 1974, Warren Publishing's Creepy. So the first page of the story here we have, let's see, what do we have? This is scripted by Mr. Bruce Jones, penciled and inked by Bernie Wrightson, and colored by Steve Olaf. Now, most of these stories in this, there are four in this book, I'll probably give pretty short shift to, because in my mind, the main point of this book, this book in particular, there may be others like this as well, but excuse me, my oldest cat here is wanting my attention for a moment, and I'm trying to extricate myself from his attention. There we go. Talking art, yes, is the reason you buy this book is for the art. The story, the story is okay. The story is the merest of the skeletons upon which this artwork in this book is hung. So far and away, Bernie Wrightson handles the art chores for all four stories. That is why you pick up this book. And auditorily, it's very difficult to pass on what this art looks like, particularly for me who doesn't have the, you know, keenest command of the English language as it is. So, the art. If you can find this book, buy it for the art. Much like other Pacific comic creator, Dave Stevens. Now, his writing is pretty good, I'll give you. But his artwork is far and away what he is known for. Bernie Wrightson, same thing in a definite horror vein. So we start. We're in the woods I'll say in a fallish kind of time frame. The woods look very much like woodlands that I find here in my home of southern West Virginia, or perhaps some of the lower elevations, of course, because above certain elevations there is no trees, hence the tree line. Lower elevations of Rocky Mountains, the Rockies, as far as the assemblage of trees and the way the trees look. But it's fall, somewhere like that. We'll say here in the Appalachians. And that's Appalachian, because if you say it wrong, I'll throw an Appalachia there, if that helps you pronounce it, Appalachian. Dude is walking around hunting. Maybe that's also why I think it's kind of fall. Shotgun, overcoat, scarf, walking around looking, you know, trying to find something to shoot. And he comes up to this dude, and this dude has a girl bound by her wrists, bent over. And he is raising this axe unto chopping her head off. And dude with the shotgun yells at him. The guy with the axe doesn't acknowledge. Finally, the new dude with the shotgun shoots him, kills him dead. Says, "Dear Lord, I've killed a man." Why didn't he listen? He goes over and scoops him up to hear his dying words. He says, "His lips are moving. He's trying to speak." And the dude with a very macabre looking, eyes rolled back in his head kind of face, "Jennifer. He's gone. It looks as though he was the one I heard crying. He heard a sound. He was following a sound in the woods. The girl, I'd better see if she's all right. God in heaven! And he thinks to himself, I've never seen anything so hideous, deformed or not. No creature deserves this. He speaks, are you all right? Did he hurt you? She doesn't speak. So he starts, you know, filling in the blanks and whatever. Ultimately, he, using the gun stock of his shotgun, he digs a hole and buries the dude in probably a very, very shallow grave. Takes the girl with him. We're told here by the narrator, the authorities did believe me. No trace of the girl's parents or next of kin could ever be found. It was right after the judge had announced his plans to place Jennifer in an institution that I first felt her eyes upon me. Those black, hideous, compelling eyes. So we see the beginning of a theme there. Wait, Your Honor, please, I'd like to apply for papers to adopt the girl. And the judge says, you want to adopt her? I kidded myself into believing Madge and the children, he's got a little boy and a little girl at home, would understand. There was no way of softening the shock. Madge, kids, this is Jennifer. She's going to live with us. Jim, good Lord, says Madge. And one of the children, the boy, says, Mommy, I'm scared. The next few weeks were a living hell for all of us. Even Jennifer, despite the hideous distortions, wore the agony on her face. And they're sitting at a dinner table trying to eat dinner. And Jennifer says, or Madge says, Timmy, eat your supper. And Timmy says, I can't, not while she's sitting across from me. Later on, they go for a drive, dude and his wife. Jim, you've got to get rid of her. I don't want to seem heartless, but she's tearing apart the family. What can I do, for God's sake, Jim says. She trusts me. It would kill her. So we go on. Now, all the time, the art. This Bernie Wrightson an art is just so fit for the horror and macabre stylings of this story. The narration and the text that I'm reading between characters and whatnot just doesn't give the artwork justice. No standard panel layout. 7, 5, 6, 8 panels. It's definitely not a 9x9 grid or anything like that. The panels vary in width and height. I was going to say depth, but yeah, it's 2D. So one night, Jim hears his wife scream and he goes to find her. And she's slumped on the floor saying that she bit me. The little witch bit me. You little monster. You disgusting little wretch. And later that night, or you know, some subsequent night, she's telling Jim, dog, you got to get rid of her. You just got to get rid of her. And Jim takes her one day to, he's trying to find an institution, and we see a picture of her, and she is a very misshapen, malformed young lady. She's difficult. So he takes her out for a drive and then just brings her home and says he wasn't able to find a place. It was overcrowded. But the question is, did he really ever end up going anywhere for real? And so to tell you the dedication in podcasting, my wife just came in here where I am and scored some chocolate, and she's going to go back in the living room, watch football, and eat chocolate while I'm slaving away on this podcast. I don't get to eat chocolate because it'd be hard to talk. That's how dedicated I am. Anyways, and she heard me, and she's standing here eating in front of me and putting the chocolate up just to bring home what I said. So there you go. That is my loving wife, folks. Thank you. Thank you. So Jim, he doesn't know what to do. He's beside himself. He is suffering just as much, maybe a little bit less than his wife is. He strips down and goes to jump in the tub where he's been running water and finds that the cat has been drowned. And the cat showed up in a couple of the scenes here in the story. So it's definite that they had a cat. The cat winds up drowned in the bathtub. Now, at first, I thought they were trying to say that Jennifer did this. But we never saw Jennifer. So now I'm wondering if the poor cat drowned itself to get away from Jennifer. That's how bad the little girl is, that the pets are killing themselves. Which... That's kind of amusing to me. I'm sorry. Because that would show that Jennifer is indeed very difficult. She even kills pets just by being around them. So finally, the wife leaves. She just can't take any more. Every time he turns around, Jennifer is here. He's talking trash to her. She never responds. One night, she comes into his bedroom dressed in his wife's gowns and forces herself, well, as much as she can, forces herself on him. They allude to the fact that he has sex with this hideous little trollish girl. Okay. So next, he goes to the world's largest collection of freaks and oddities and tries to sell her to the keeper of this establishment, who arranges one day when Jim is not there to steal into the house, kidnap the girl, and escort her away. Well, Jim comes back and he looks around and he's checking around and she's not here, and it's, oh, happy, happy celebration. So he reaches in the fridge for a brewski and he finds the dismembered corpse of the man that he had hired to steal Jennifer hidden away in the icebox in the kitchen. So that's it. He becomes a little bit more than a little unhinged. Another night of mad passion between she and he, with him protesting, Jennifer, please, not tonight. Yeah, apparently tonight was okay because you were able to consummate. So it's, you know, yeah, okay. So now he's taken to going for walks to try to ease his mind, you know, whatever have you. And he's out walking around. I'll kill myself. That's the answer. But he comes back and there's a fresh bottle of booze because he's walking off a bender. And he comes back and there's a fresh bottle there to get in a new bender. Walking around town at some point later, he sees a newspaper talking about a missing girl. And he runs home and starts checking around to see if the little girl, if Jennifer has done something to the little girl. And sure enough, Jennifer is in the basement with the little girl dismembered. I don't know if she's just killed it and cut it apart or if she's in the process of eating it or whatever. Well, Jim's had enough. He runs out, runs into the town, breaks a window on a hardware store, grabs a pick or a Maddox, one or the other. Maybe this is a Maddox, actually. It's not a pick. It's more than that. Grabs Jennifer, takes her out into the woods, and he ties her hands behind her back, and he's going to, oh no, it's not a Maddox. It's an axe. It's a two-bit axe, double-bit axe. And he's going to decapitate her, and he raises the axe to cut her head off, and blam! Some guy with a shotgun shoots him and kills him. And as the dude is holding him as he dies, he says to the new dude, Jennifer. And so it starts all over again. All right, second story is H.P. Lovecraft's Cool Air. And this originally showed up in Eerie number 62 from January 1975. This is a story. It starts out, the gentleman is telling us why, or he's going to tell us why he does not like cold air. Starts out that he is, or excuse me, this is scripted, penciled, and inked by Bernie Wrightson with colors by Steve Olaf. And we also see down here at the bottom of the page that it is copywritten in 1939, renewed in 1967 by August Derleth and Donald Wandry. Hardcore Lovecraftian Cthulhu authors, Cthulhu mythos. In the spring of 1923, I had secured some dreary and unprofitable magazine work in New York City, says Dude. So he's in the story, and he's also our narrator. He hears this constant low machinery hum from coming upstairs, as his upstairs neighbor. One day, he notices a leak in the ceiling, and the liquid streams down into his apartment, and he checks it out and finds it's ammonia. And because of this, or just juxtaposed to it, he has a heart attack. And he crawls to the upstairs apartment that turns out to be a Dr. Munoz, to because it was his last thought as his consciousness was rattled by the heart attack. And he drags himself up there and finds that the guy, he collapsed on the stoop, and the guy took him in and is helping him recover. And he says, why is it so cold in here? And Dr. Munoz tells him, my apologies for your discomfort, but the low temperature is absolutely necessary, I assure you. And at this point, I instantly knew what this dude was. In fact, a higher temperature would prove fatal. I was stricken with a rare disease 18 years ago. My regimen has included constant cold. It's called death, by the way, in case you want to know. Dude is dead, but he's kept himself alive, and we'll find out. So he's telling the dude, and over time they grow close to each other. Dr. Munoz completely cured Dudleo's heart condition, so he is now much beholden to Dr. Munoz. And so they start spending more and more time together. The guy starts becoming like the workman super for Dr. Munoz's apartment, doing small repairs and things like that. And finally, he finds out that Dr. Munoz, through old Egyptian, old world endeavors and power of the mind and all these other things, have kept himself alive and in suspended animation. He's willed himself to stay alive, even though he is in fact dead. On and on and on until one day there's massive thumping on the ceiling, Munoz's floor, as he's trying to get dude's attention. He runs up to the doctor. The doctor tells him the pump stopped. It's getting warmer. And so he runs down and gets his tools and comes back upstairs, and Munoz tells him it must be fixed quickly. And so he says he left and returned with a mechanic from a nearby all-night garage. It's no use. It's got to be replaced. Shops are closed till 8 in the morning. And Dr. Munoz is like, oh, no. He raged and cursed violently for several hours till a severe spasm sent him screaming, hands covering his eyes, into the bathroom. He appeared at the door moments later, his face tightly bandaged. And this was the door to his apartment. He had shut dude out. He tells dude, bring ice, lots of it, quickly. And he starts bringing big, huge blocks of ice and leaving them outside. And every time he's there, Dr. Munoz is just telling him, more, more, bring more. So finally, 8 o'clock the next day, he goes to a shop to find a replacement for the piston, a broken piston. I found a man who, after much pleading and emptying of pockets, agreed to keep Dr. Munoz supplied with ice till I returned. He went to get the part, and it took just far longer than he could imagine to get the piston and somebody to work on it and everything like that. Well, in the meantime, he found the dude that was bringing the ice, and he just had some wild stories about his brief interaction with Dr. Munoz, to the extent that he quit bringing the ice. So the dude breaks into his apartment, goes and finds a nasty, ugly, sludgy trail everywhere in the apartment as Munoz was dragging himself from room to room to room, until finally on a couch here is just the decomposed, totally decomposed, via Bernie Writes and Visuals, body of Dr. Munoz. And he tells him, there was a gradual alteration I had not foreseen, but it had to be done this way, artificial preservation. For you see, I died that time 18 years ago. So he was dead and willed himself to stay alive and needed the cold to help him and lost the cold, etc., etc. Next is a single page with four vertical columns, all drawn by Bernie Wrightson, of Martians as depicted by, from left to right, H.G. Wells, Edgar Rice Burroughs, Ray Bradbury, and Frederick Brown. So there's Bernie Wrightson's interpretation of Martians as described by those four writers, creators. Midnight Gods by John Pound, a deluxe oversized portfolio. I spoke of this when I was talking about the last book, Alien Worlds. Six panels for $35, $1.75 postage. Next page is a new release page. Gru, Bernie writes in Edge of Chaos, Alien Worlds, Twisted Tales, Captain Victory, Silver Star, and Elric of Melniboné. The next story is The Laughing Man, and it is scripted by Bruce Jones, inked and penciled by Bernie Wrightson, and colored by Steve Olaf. And this is the story of Mark Tanner and Jeff Briggs, as told by a third-party narrator. It also involves a Dr. Carl Richards. He is tending to some people in Africa, one of the tribes there. He's the doctor trying to help them along in the Ugani Valley, U-G-H-A-N-I, Ugani Valley of Mosebeke, M-O-S-E-B-K-E-I, Mosebeke. Carl Richards is there helping the peoples. And in comes Jeff Briggs, and he is crazy. He's lost his mind. Mark Tanner. I'm sorry. Alone? Not alone. Briggs. Came with Briggs, he's telling when he's laughing and hee-hawing and all this kind of stuff. Well, the doctor, Richards, finally gives him something that knocks him out. And when he comes to, he's a little bit more able-minded and able to tell a story. Tanner and Briggs owned a carnival, a traveling carnival, in the late 30s, early 40s. And Briggs saw in a paper a picture of the man-ape that the natives called Waki. And it looks like a man wearing a little helmet of some sort. But it's a legendary creature thought to be a local tribe of thinking gorillas. So Briggs decides that if they can bring one home alive, hopefully, that'll be worth more money. But dead, even, to prove that they exist, they'll be made. So they sell the carny, put all of their money together to go on safari, expedition is a better word, to Africa. And they get here. They can't find any guides because they're all spooked by going into this mystical, scary creature valley. So they won't go into Waki country, none of the guides. So finally, Briggs finds a map of questionable report, purchased from somebody of questionable repute to lead them to the home of these Wakti peoples. As they're paddling down a river, Briggs looks out through some binoculars and sees them. So he knows that they are in the correct area. He sets a snare and ultimately, via the snare, ends up killing one of the creatures. So Tanner is trying to go home. We got one. Let's take it. And Briggs is like, no. Dead is cool, but it'd be better if we got one alive. So he's not going to leave now until he catches one alive. He designs a better mousetrap. This time, he takes this creature and skins it and puts on its skin to imitate one of the Wakti and then sits in the midst of the next trap. So his thought is to, I guess, using himself as bait to live capture one of these things. I'm not quite sure. The trap isn't laid out, so we don't know how that's going to work exactly. But that's what he's going to do. Well, he disappears, but then he shows up. And he shows up mute and starts leading Tanner, you know, we need to go here, we need to leave, get the boat, go down this way, go down the river, go away. And finally, to convince the guy, Tanner, to go away, Briggs rips off the skin, and it turned out to be one of these monkey creatures that had skinned Briggs and put the skin on to bait Tanner into, quote-unquote, being trapped or doing what he wanted him to do. And so that's why he went crazy. Now, again, I know a lot of these stories, I'm not really leaving out big chunks, but I'm not telling everything because the artwork in this book is the thing to get. Next is a story of Clarice, and not the one that ate Chianti and what was it, fava beans or something like that. Yeah, that's not her. This is a story of a young couple homesteading, maybe, in a cabin out in the middle of nowhere in the winter, and they're just living. One night, she goes out to get some more firewood, and he is there and getting ready for bed, and so he inadvertently falls asleep, and because he sleeps hard, and he did not hear her scream and yell and beg to get back into the cabin in the midst of this massive snowstorm that's going on. So finally he wakes up the next morning and realizes she never came back, and he opens the door and finds her laying on the ground covered in snow, frozen, dead. He buries her, but no amount of anything can ever get his perceived memories of the sounds that she must have made that night. Because again, the real things he did not hear because he was asleep like a log. So in his mind, he hears her yelling and screaming and begging day after day after night. Until one night, he hears them and believes that they're real and answers the door. And when he opens the door, she is standing there in the full bloom of life while he is this old, wretched, decrepit thing kneeling at her feet in the door. And that's where the story ends. So I don't know if he perhaps knelt here and died with the door open to the cabin. And this is a scene years later after he is decomposed or whatever. But yeah. And the narration is via poetry, which I won't read to you. Now this is a standard panel layout. This is four panels per page all the way through. The poem is four lines per panel. So it's a, what is that, a quatrain? Yeah, I don't know much about poetry. I don't know much about history. I don't know biology. That's not true. I have a degree in biology, actually. I know a little bit about science books. I know nothing about the German I took. I don't remember it. I'll stop now. Dragons number 2 by Layla Dowling. I believe we ran across maybe Dragons number 1 in one of the previous books. This is a portfolio. It is 6 plates. All of them are 2 color, 11.5 by 16. Very large plates. All for only $20. So here, 6 plates for $20. Whereas the other dude was 6 plates for $35. So this is a much better value. And dare I say, probably more interesting for me because dragons are the theme. Inside back cover is the next cover for the Bernie Wrightson Master of the Macabre, issue number 3. And this is, yeah, I'll talk about the image of the cover next time anyways. And back cover is a black and white mock-up of the cover. Well, it's going to turn out, I think, to be the first cover for Somerset Holmes. When this book starts, alone, vulnerable, terrified, she doesn't know who she is, where she came from, or why they're trying to kill her. Jones and Anderson this summer from PC Comics. So that is something to look forward to, and laying that down and picking up our third book as we hit the hour mark. I don't think I'm going to break the file. I'm just going to keep going and have this one larger than normal file. Hope that doesn't offend anybody too much, but it's what I'm going to do. Michael Moorcock's Elric of Melniboné, issue number 2, is next up. Wait for it. The cover brought to us, penciled, inked, and colored by P. Craig Russell and Michael T. Gilbert. The letter is, it's typeset, so yeah, it's some kind of mechanical thing, I think, typeset. Front cover, I believe this is an image of Dr. Jest's workshop, nay, dungeon, where he tortures people, like a performance art rather than a creative art. It tells us that in the book here. Kindly Dr. Jest. And Roy Thomas. That'll be the story itself, Roy Thomas. But interesting image, Michael Moorcock's Elric of Melniboné. Just a very interesting image here to start the book off with on the front cover. Not full color, or maybe it is, and they only chose to use a couple 3 colors. Inside is a recap for half of the inside front cover. The other is an editorial by Mr. Mike Friedrich, who is the editor of this here book. From the Chronicles of the Black Sword called Stormbringer. Being a tale of Elric of Melniboné in the days before he did possess that magical blade. No, that's not true, because he gets dressed in here and he has Stormbringer and Mournblade as part of his dress. But so this is scripted by Mr. Roy Thomas, penciled, inked, and colored by Craig Russell, with pencil and color assists from Michael T. Gilbert, lettered by Mr. Tom Orzechowski, for me, of X-Men fame. But I know he did stuff before that. Next page is full page. Welcome to the... full page? Next page is full color. Welcome to the domain of Dr. Jest. It's got a creatives at the bottom here. Epic hero adapted from the pages of his novel, Elric of Melniboné. Outside the Dreaming City. Ho, my Lord Emperor! Well, they found us at last, eh, dear Cimmeril? Yes, Elric. Fear not, Captain. We'll soon all be dry again. My Lord Emperor is needed at Monshenjik Tower, where spies are being held. Spies? Aye, caught in the sea maze this morning. Southern barbarians by their dress and awaiting your questioning, my lord. Some of your guardsmen will accompany Milady Cimmeril into the city. I would see the brave fools who dared Melniboné's sea maze. And he takes off towards the tower. Beautifully, beautifully illustrated by Mr. Russell. Misters Russell and Gilbert. Awesome art. Yet again, another book that, particularly if you have read any of Elric's novels, I think this is a just beautiful accompaniment for the eyes with its hit-and-miss portions of the novel, which most novelizations will fall into that. But the artwork is just P. Craig Russell. Yeah. So we have an image of the tower here with Elric running up to it. But then in the background, we see this big ocean that the island is abuts. It's an island nation. And we see boats on the ocean there. Elric riding into the tower, going deeper and deeper and deeper into the tower until he comes to the offices, shall we say, of Dr. Jest, who we're told he practices art, a performance art, rather than a creative art. Though he has been heard to argue otherwise with some conviction, his art, that of drawing secrets from those who would prefer to keep them. He is Dr. Jest. And so basically, you know, I mean, he's a torturer. Much like the, what was it? The Tales of Earth, U-R-T-H, by, I forget the author's name, but that was a member of the Torturers Guild, who decided after passing and becoming a full-fledged torturer that he did not want to torture anymore. The Dark Earth, the Black Earth, something like that, U-R-T-H. Fascinating books for me when I was in high school, 16, 17 years old to read those. Very interesting. But Jest has tortured the information out of these two, and these two that he's working on here. Now, we find that there have been various individuals attempt to find their way through the sea maze to then take that information back to all the various agglomerations of peoples that want to invade Melnibone. But either they were not able to find their way all the way in, they were not able to find their way all the way out, they got captured in the interim, but people are always trying to find their way through the sea maze, and no one has ever succeeded up to this point. So here are more people that have failed. These two people, a young woman and an even younger male child, are tortured to find out that they are spies that a group came in, and at different points, the group broke and members returned to their origin to take the information they had up to that point. So they were doing it very stepwise. And these two were caught as they were attempting to go back to take what information had been gained to their leaders. Earlier and over several instances, others had been caught, and the final four had been actually caught in the maze and had been killed in the maze. So they were not able to get any information out of them. Others were killed, so these were the first in a long time that they had captured alive and were able to glean any kind of information from. We'll come to find out, the, what do they call it, barbarian hordes, I think. Barbarians. Yeah, some amount of uncivilized peoples have gotten together and are planning a big let's take down Melnibone party. So that is already in the works. They're already on their way. And so now Elric must defend the realm. That is of utmost priority. So he does so. He gathers his generals to him. First is the Prince Yurkun, who wants his job. And also in attendance is Divim Dvar, the dragon army leader, which Yurkun, his thoughts are to just take the dragons and sick the dragons on them and burn them and sink them and kill everybody, and, you know, we'll be done with it. We don't have to do anything. We don't have to raise a blade, nothing. And Divim is like, well, that would work, except the last time you chose to use the dragons that way, well, they haven't recovered from. They're still asleep, gaining their energy, and they won't wake up until they're ready to go, and that is not today. Today is not that day. And so Elric says, well, then I guess what we're going to have to do is man up and go out and do it ourselves. So he tells everybody to be ready, you know, first thing in the morning, something like that. And we'll enter the sea maze and we'll catch them as they are entering the outside of the maze and get them there. So they break up and we follow Elric as he goes to his quarters, and we're introduced to Tanglebones, who is his manservant and apparently has been around serving the emperor, because he served the previous emperor prior to Elric also. So he is the emperor's manservant as opposed to Elric's personal manservant. we're introduced to the whatever armor, black armor, dark armor, midnight armor, whatever. It's very, very dark. But more importantly in this scene, we are dropped the names of the two rune swords that the Emperor wields, those being Stormbringer and Mournblade, the aforementioned Stormbringer that I mentioned. And we see some character growth here from Elric as he's talking to Tanglebones about what he must do, previous emperors, what Tanglebones knows, etc., etc. Later, attired in dark armor, he stands now upon the gold-shielded deck of the Son of the Pirarae, flagship of the Imperial Fleet. Listening to the hollow slap of the water against the sides of the ship, Elric wishes he had been able to conceive a better plan than this. Basically, what they're going to do is all of the amassed armada are going to stream out from home base through the sea maze towards open ocean. And as they are nearing the open ocean side of the maze, various numbers of the ships of the armada will break off into the subsequent pathways of the maze and hide and wait. Then what the armada will do is they will go out and break and allow the ships to pass into the maze, close behind them. And then as the barbarian ships go through the maze, these various branches of the maze will be opened up, and the ships hiding there will then attack, and they will in essence be surrounded on all sides because the first part has closed in the back. So that is the plan. Yurkun is using some of his magic to hide those ships that have splintered off and are hiding in the branches of the maze. That's his job. Elric is captain, commodore of the armada itself, so he's in the lead taking the ships out. They go out. They wait. The barbarian ships pass. They close in behind them. Half-page panel image of the Numenorean fleet. Yeah, no, it's not Numenor. It's the Melnibonean fleet. In these huge golden pyramidal-shaped ships, huge compared to the... we see 7. We see 7 ships of the barbarians. And if they were lined up side by side, they would not reach the width of the one golden pyramid ship of the Melnibonians. So all of the ships are that big. Needless to say, it's not necessarily a close battle, but it is much closer than Elric would prefer it to be. So the battle gets underway, but not before we have an ad for Pacific Comics continuing to lead the way with mock-ups of Elric issue 2, Bernie Wrightson issue 2, Captain Victory issue, I can't make it out, Alien Worlds issue 3, Vanguard Illustrated 1, and Somerset Holmes number 2. It's interesting, number 2 already, because we haven't seen 1 come through yet. And then we have, so this is Master of the Macabre issue 2 here. Because on the next page is a full color mock-up of the cover for Bernie Wrightson Master of the Macabre issue 2, which you just spent a little bit of time listening to me drone on about. Hopefully it wasn't boring droning. Full page image on the next page of the Melnibonean ships just taking out the various barbarian ships. Looks like they're using fireball launchers and launching fireballs at them. So now they have destroyed all of the ships that they can here, but we find out from Prince Yurkun that 4 ships escaped the pincer and are heading back home. And Elric says, let them go. You know, they've lost. They're going to go talk about how they've lost and whatever. And Yurkun says, well, Your Majesty, 2 things will happen. Everyone else will find out how weak you are in allowing anybody to escape. And 2, the amount of information that they do have will get back and will be used against you, showing how weak you are. So actually, in letting them escape, all you're doing is showing how weak you are. And the snake venom is taken to heart by Elric, and he's like, all right then, pursue them and kill them to the man. And Yurkun's like, oh, goody, 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 get to kill, get to kill. And so they head off. They take several of the command ships, not all of them, because they don't need all of them. Several of them head out after these four ships. Well, they do catch up with the ships, but before they can destroy them, the ships turn at them and attack them. And so now, Yurkun and Elric do some hand-to-hand, and Elric is pretty capable hand-to-hand. That's one of the things that got him to be the Emperor, is prowess with his hand-to-hand combat. The problem is that being albino, which he is, I don't know if I've said that, but he is. And part of his albinism is physical issues. He weakens quickly. He has to do things, meditate, take certain medicines and things like that to maintain the strength to do all the things that he needs to do on a daily basis. Much less go out like this, full body armor, and exert himself. But for short periods of time, he is more than capable of doing this. And this is one of those periods of time. He meets the captain of one of the other ships and bests him rather handily, cuts his head off, throws it overboard because, I don't know, I guess that's the sign of disrespect, is throwing a bodiless head overboard. I don't know. Yurkun comes at him again, talking about how fortunate he was that time. And we still have some ships left, and so they chase after them, loosing some fireballs ahead of them to damage those ships before they can get to them. Also to prevent them from turning and attacking like this ship did. We have a Craig Russell portfolio, excuse me, The Curse of the Ring advertised next. It is $15 for... it doesn't tell us, except that the stock is 80-pound stock. Complete notes by Patrick Mason on each. Limited to 1,200, but it doesn't tell how many plates per set that I see. Allow 6 to 8 weeks for delivery. The Melniboneans continue their attack on these barbarian ships. Eventually, all the remaining, which is, this says four, but, or actually, this has more ships than that. I thought only four got by them, but apparently it's more than four ships, because in the midst of the Melniboneans attacking, all these ships turn in towards the Melniboneans, much like they had done previously. So now we have fit ships and ships on fire, crashing against the Melniboneian boats, trying to down them, drown them, sink them. Once again, Yurkun and Elric go hand to hand. Elric dispatches a pair of guys here, and he's shown to be weakening. Finally, the captain of one of these ships jumps him and pretty much has the better of him, but he is ultimately able to fell the dude and then passes out, only to be awakened by Yurkun, who in no small way lets Elric know that he could have kept him unconscious, you know, like permanently. And so, I am still your leader. All right to Emir, then, that I may sit once more upon the ruby throne. We've saved the day. So it's only a matter of time before Yurkun attempts to usurp, or does truly usurp, the throne, the ruby throne. Next page is an editorial by Roy Thomas talking about Mike Friedrich, predominantly is what he's talking about, and Star Reach Productions, which the book Star Reach I have in there also. And next season of Newsprint Commando, I'm seriously thinking about talking about it. We'll see. Somerset Holmes ad, black and white, different images on this one than the previous one. Midnight Gods by John Pound portfolio on the inside back cover, black and white. And then the back cover is another circlet in the middle of the page, taking about, I don't know, 25-30% of the page, with an image of, looks like Elric casting some spells in armor here in the image. There's a sword behind the circle, scrying sphere that we're looking at, with some kind of shadow creature entwined upon it. And that is it for Elric of Melniboné. And I believe that should be it for finishing up this episode of Newsprint Commando Pacific Comics. Now, looking at my handy-dandy list here, next up will be, for Newsprint Commando, X-Mutants number 6. But the next Pacific Tuesday will have a variety of books. And those books include and probably will be limited to the Joe Kubrick First Portfolio, Bernie Wrightson's Master of the Macabre Issue 3, Captain Victory and the Galactic Rangers Issue 12, Edge of Chaos Issue 2, Gray Morrow's Edge of Chaos, Elric of Melniboné Issue 3, Gru the Wanderer Issue 5, Silver Star Issue 4, Somerset Holmes, there we are, Issue 1, and Twisted Tales Issue 4. Now, I didn't do it this time. I did it a previous multi-book episode, and I most certainly will do it this Pacific Tuesday episode in question. I'll break that up into separate files so that the one file hopefully is no longer than an hour, perhaps a little bit less. So I don't know, 2 to 3 books a file, so that'll be 3 to 4 different files for you to download and listen to at your leisure. But before then, it will be X-Mutants issue number 6 from Pied Piper Comics to get you through your day. Thanks, folks. Talk to you next time. Ciao.